Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Wednesday, February 24th, 2021. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Council approves valet parking for downtown Midland. Agreement calls for a lease of three parking spots to be used as part of valet service outside of Midland Tower Building. By Caitlin Randall. Some downtown parking spaces will now be used to offer valet services at Opal's Table, Cancun Grill, and other nearby restaurants. The Midland City Council on Tuesday approved leasing out three parking spaces on Colorado Street to a private company that will provide valet services for downtown businesses. The parking spaces will be used for a drop-off and pickup area, and vehicles will be stored in two privately owned parking lots. Anyone who comes down to either the restaurants or clients from our various businesses complain about the parking, said Sherman Jameson, who represents the valet company, during Tuesday's council meeting. The owner of 223 West Wall Street, where Opal's Table, second-story co-working, and Cancun Grill are located, requested leasing the spaces for a valet service, according to city planning documents. The city will charge $1,000 to lease the spaces for 1 year. The owner of Midland Tower is former Mayor Wes Perry. Council member Scott Dufford said he supported creating a valet option because there's limited parking available in that downtown shopping area. I think it's worth giving it a shot myself because we definitely need more parking downtown, and this is one way to add to that, he said. Staff with Development Services and Engineering Services, however, recommended denying the request, according to city planning documents. The applicant will profit from the use of public on-street parking, staff stated as reason for recommending a denial. Additionally, this request would remove the use of public on-street parking in a high-demand area of downtown that has several retail and dining options. City staff also noted this is the first request the council has received to lease public parking for private use and would likely establish a precedent for other requests. The City Council approved the request in a 5-2 vote for 1 year, with an amendment by Councilmember Lori Blong that the applicant follow up with the council about the success of the business after a year. Councilmember Jack Ladd agreed with Development and Engineering staff's assessment that the valet company will profit more from the endeavor than the city. I think we need it, but it's a private company. Basically, it's a nominal fee, he said, of what the company will pay to lease the spaces. They'll make $1,000 in one night or one weekend. Shouldn't they pay a little more, or pay a $1 fee for every car to the city? The company, Midland Valet, according to city documents, will charge $7 for each car parked, Jameson said. Mayor Patrick Payton said leasing the spaces for 1 year is a test, and the council will consider charging an additional fee if the lease is renewed. The amount of that fee would depend on the success of the company, he said. The valet service will be available Monday through Saturday from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The spaces that will be leased are the diagonal parking spots in front of Opal's Table near the downtown library. The handicapped space will not be impacted by the valet service. This article is entitled Study. Midland County ranks as one of most generous in Texas, by Stuart Doreen. Midland County ranked fourth across the state when it came to contributions as a percentage of income, according to a study from the financial technology company Smart Asset. The study showed Midland's contributions as a percentage of income at 2.4%. That put Midland behind the following counties: Shackelford, 2.94%, Hemphill, 2.57%, and Gillespie, 2.50%. Midland was the lone Permian Basin county to crack the top 10. The study also showed Midland County ranked as the 10th most generous. Smart Asset showed the top five to be Kendall, Rockwall, Collin, Denton, and Fort Bend. Midland again was the lone Permian Basin county in the top 10. To find the most generous places, we looked at two factors in each county: how much money people donate as a percentage of their net income, and the proportion of people who made charitable donations, Smart Asset reported. The most generous counties were 1 Kendall, 2 Rockwall, 3 Collin, 4 Denton, 5 Fort Bend, 6 Travis, 7 Montgomery, 8 Gillespie, 9 Comal, 10 Midland. Contributions as percentage of income: 1 Shackelford, 2 Hemphill, 3 Gillespie, 4 Midland, 5 Hartley. This article is entitled Black History Month. Roy Nelson Sees Himself as a Resource for the Community, by Mella McEwen. Insurance was not in Roy Nelson's forecast for his future. "Accounting was my first career choice," he said, sitting in his State Farm office at 910 West Wall Street. He recounted, in pursuit of that goal, working at Gulf Oil as part of vocational office education. "I realized I couldn't be cooped up in an office all day," he recalled with a laugh. So he turned to a lifelong interest, the weather. "I've always been a weather fanatic, so I went to Texas A&M and I got a degree in meteorology," he said. Nelson said he was groomed for business by the example set by his mother, a beautician, and his father, who held numerous jobs. Those jobs ranged from raising hogs, cows, chickens, and ducks, to running concessions for the Lions Club and Carver Youth Center, and working as a wait server, bartender, and parking attendant. He said his father also worked for Shell Oil and had a janitorial service at Forest Oil. At the time, clerical positions like the one his father had at Shell offered openings into the professional world for black folk in Midland, he said. While at A&M, where the black student population was less than a half of a percent, "I could go a whole day and not see another black person," he said. It was an experience similar to his years at Midland Lee, where about 10% of the student population was black. At times, he said, there would be only one other black student in his class. Nelson explained that his was the last segregated class at Bunch Elementary when integration began in Midland in 1968. "It was an opportunity for us to have the same type of education, the same type of equipment, the same type of exposure to opportunities," he said, of integration. "It also required us to be bused from the South Side, in my case, to Alamo Junior High. My dad had 3 or 4 jobs, so if I missed the bus, I had to walk home. The busing requirements limited our extracurricular activities because of the busing system and not readily having rides." During the process, he said he saw a number of his classmates from Bunch who didn't feel the same assimilation, not handled the transition well. "I think maybe I did well. I think some smarter than me, as talented as anyone, didn't handle the transition as well. They didn't get the same encouragement from teachers, and some fell by the wayside." He himself would be told by his teacher, Maybeth Tryon, that he wasn't like his sister Barbara or cousin Jimmy, all in an effort to push him to work harder. At Lee, some experiences were unpleasant, but you deal with it and keep moving. "I didn't shy away from being the only or one of a few black students in the class." That is one reason he got involved in youth mentoring, among his many community activities. "I had so many mentors growing up," he said, "from local mentors like James Bradford, James Fuller, pastors I.M. Woodford, L.E. Oshie, and G.T. Curry, Boy Scout leader Floyd Brooks, football coach James Smokey Young, and track coaches Clarence Johnson and Johnny Williams, and Dr. Viola Coleman, who was an insurance customer of his. Going through her papers after she passed, he said he came across correspondence between her and Thurgood Marshall, the late Supreme Court Justice. There are other historical figures he wants to emphasize to Midland's younger black community. Ralph Bunche, a negotiator for the United Nations on Peace for Israel and winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. And W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King Jr., Mahalia Jackson, Langston Hughes. "Sometimes you need to look back and think on the people who got you here," he said. Hughes's comment on dreams being deferred pushed me along, he said. "You think of your dreams and ensure you keep your focus, keep committed to the things you dream of. You have to see if they come to life and ensure opportunity doesn't pass you by." He sees himself as a resource for the community through keeping history alive and his community work with local chambers, his church, and organizations like the Negro Business and Professional Women's Club and the local chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. His passion for helping others is what led him to his career in insurance, where he has had a State Farm insurance office since 1996. Armed with his meteorological degree from A&M, he found there were no meteorological jobs in Midland. So he joined a seismic company doing seismic processing, studying patterns underground rather than in the sky. He then took a job in Alabama with the Tennessee Valley Authority that I thought would be meteorology, but turned out to be environmental sciences. Then the oil patch called me, and I came back to Midland in 1981. At that time, he got another job in seismic processing, but the job changed dramatically, and he decided to get a second degree in geology, only to suffer a series of layoffs amid the industry downturn. But some college and high school classmates of his began talking about insurance claims adjusting, and he saw it as a way to help. He went to work in claims and realized he liked helping people recover from their claims, but it didn't leave him much time for his community work. So he joined an agency that not only let him help people with financial issues and financial planning, but gave him time for his community work. I see my role here now as a stabilizer for my community, an example of diversity and now longevity. Nelson said, "I want to be a resource, an encourager, a service. I want to serve my community and provide direction, help people to make more of their opportunities and the best of their financial resources. In the long run, help them to save money by preparing for the risks of everyday life and seeing their dreams come to pass." At his agency, he said he has a diverse book of business from mayors and city leaders. Black business persons, to school superintendents and administrators, to those with menial assets, that made me recognize how grateful I am for God's provisions. Many customers struggled to pay their insurance, but have grown from the advice and protection he offered. "I particularly recall one of my customers who had to count every dime, questioning any change in her rate. Then she was blessed with an opportunity at management, and now she is rolling. Another went from small beginnings to a major business owner. One gentleman I thought about hiring from a bank in a few years became owner of an oil company. I've seen it happen, and I am thankful to have played a small part." This article is entitled, "Texas Electricity Supplier Hit with $1 Billion Class Action Lawsuit for Price Gouging After Outages," by Dom DeFurio, Dallas Morning News. Texas power supplier Gritty is the target of a class action lawsuit filed in Houston State District Court Monday, alleging the company participated in price gouging after Winter Storm Uri cut power to millions across the state. The lawsuit was filed by a Chambers County resident, Lisa Curry, whose electricity bill from the week of the storm totaled $9,340, according to the suit. Corey's normal monthly bill averages between $200 and $250. The proposed class action lawsuit, which will include all Texans who used electricity services from Gritty and were hit with excessive charges resulting from the storm, according to a release from Houston-based Potts Law Firm. The lawsuit seeks more than $1 billion in financial relief for the affected customers. "At this point, we don't know how many people might be affected, but there are likely thousands of customers who've received these outrageous bills," attorney Derek Potts, who represents Ms. Curry, said in a statement. "A class action will be the most efficient and effective way for Gritty's customers to come together and fight this predatory pricing." In Texas's deregulated energy market, Gritty, and a handful of other electricity suppliers charge customers wholesale variable rates for power. Those plans are relatively new and have frustrated customers now dealing with expensive bills for a week where power was intermittent for many. This is the region and state page. This article is entitled, "Here's How Much UT is Paying Its New Football Coach," by Anna Canizales, Texas Tribune. Steve Sarkisian, the new head football coach at the University of Texas at Austin, is guaranteed to make at least $34.2 million throughout his six-year contract, according to a UT Board of Regents meeting agenda. The board is expected to approve Sarkisian's salary Thursday. Sarkisian, who was hired January 2nd, will make $5.2 million in his first year as coach and is guaranteed a $200,000 raise each year. Sarkisian's compensation also includes two dealership cars, 20 hours of private airplane use per year, and a $250,000 relocation and temporary housing allowance. He will additionally receive a one-time payment of $1.2 million if he is still head coach on December 31st, 2024. All of these funds will come from Texas Athletics, whose budget includes revenue from multiple sources, including licensing, broadcasting rights, ticket sales, and donors, according to university spokesperson J.B. Byrd. "Our entire community benefits from a healthy and successful athletics program, and naming Steve as our coach infuses our football program with the necessary guidance and expertise to drive further success," UT Austin President Jay Hartzell said in a statement when Sarkisian was hired. The board will also approve the guaranteed compensation of coordinators and assistant football coaches, most of which exceed $1 million. Offensive coordinator Kyle Flood's salary will start at $1.1 million and increase by $75,000 each year during his three-year contract. Special teams coordinator Jeff Banks will make $1 million in his first year and an additional $50,000 for the remaining 2 years of his contract. All assistant coaches, except receivers coach Andre Coleman and running backs coach Stan Drayton, are also guaranteed one dealership car and a $29,000 relocation and temporary housing allowance. Sarkisian's starting salary is over $5 million more than former head coach Tom Herman and $10 million more than former head coach Charlie Strong, according to the Dallas Morning News. The university is still paying Herman $15 million over the next 3 years as part of his termination contract. The money to buy out Herman's contract will come from Texas Athletics, multiple sources of revenue. But no money will come from the university's budget, Byrd said. The university fired Herman January 2nd after 4 seasons, saying a coaching change would help the team get on track to achieve our ambitious goals. During Herman's time as head coach, he went 32-18 and led the Longhorns to rank as high as 8th in the AP Top 25 in 2020. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, "Freeze in Texas Exposed the Danger of Deregulation," by Catherine Rampel, Washington Post Writers Group. Republican politicians have spent several decades fear-mongering about job-killing regulations. Perhaps the ongoing energy crisis in Texas provides a useful opportunity to examine job-killing deregulation instead. Since at least the Reagan era, the GOP has worshipped at the altar of deregulation. Politicians promulgated the myth that all regulation is anti-growth, and therefore any regulatory rollback is inherently pro-growth. In particular, they touted the Texas energy market as a sort of paragon of their deregulatory fantasy, an invisible hand success story that should be expanded nationwide. It's so pro-business, after all. But if you were trying to run a business in Texas last week, or a decade ago, when severe winter weather previously knocked out power, you might have a different perspective. Texas has long prided itself on its laissez-faire wholesale energy market, which dates to a deregulatory push in the 1990s. The Texas grid enjoys little government oversight from the feds or the state, and compared to other states, has almost no regulatory safeguards to ensure sufficient energy is available when demand spikes. So averse are Texas politicians to the idea of government intervention that most of the state is not connected to interstate grids. This exempts the Texas energy system from the purview of a federal regulatory commission. It also means the state cannot borrow energy from neighbors if its grid falters. The deregulatory evangelists argued that such fail-safes were not necessary, because market forces could ensure there were no energy shortages or service disruptions. When demand is high, prices will rise. This should incentivize producers to switch on facilities that might otherwise be offline. This money-making prospect should also induce companies to invest in the maintenance and weatherization that would enable generators to fire up whenever necessary, including during extreme temperatures. Otherwise, they'd miss out on huge windfalls. That was the theory, anyway. Instead, this deregulated market led to a race to the bottom. Deregulation has kept energy prices low and made price competition more cutthroat, which encourages producers to trim costs wherever possible. With the likelihood of severe winter cold seemingly remote, energy companies had little incentive to make the costly capital investments necessary to weatherize. No government entity forced them to make these investments, so why bother spending the money? Neither did regulators force generators to maintain a reserve margin of extra power above expected demand, as other states do. Most of the time during the usually balmy Texas winter, this deregulated system has functioned fine. But severe weather can bring it crashing down. Sub-freezing temperatures last week caused demand to spike, raising prices as predicted. But however much producers might have wanted to ramp up supply, they couldn't, because they were felled by those same sub-freezing temperatures. The cold appears to have disrupted operations at power plants, pipelines, oil and gas wells, wind turbines, and other parts of the supply chain. This led to widespread, days-long power and heat outages, causing deaths from hypothermia and carbon monoxide poisoning, shortages of potable water, and surprise energy bills, some above $10,000, for those lucky enough to have even occasionally had power. These were foreseeable consequences of the state's refusal to require energy producers to weatherize or maintain reserve margins. So foreseeable, in fact, that we'd actually seen them before. A 2011 winter storm also led to blackouts across Texas for the same reason. Afterward, federal officials made recommendations for Texas to winterize its energy system. The 2011 report noted that similar recommendations had been made after a winter storm-related blackouts in 1989. Both times, the recommendations were mostly ignored. With climate change likely to cause extreme weather events with greater frequency, Texas can expect repeats in the years ahead. So why have these regulatory recommendations been ignored so far? Because to Republican politicians, regulations equal bad. In the throes of the current crisis, as people were dying of hypothermia, Republican former Governor Rick Perry, a past U.S. Energy Secretary, declared that Texans are willing to suffer extended blackouts for the paramount objective of keeping the feds out of their grid. Apparently, the warm, fuzzy feeling some Texans get from bucking regulators must substitute for actual heat. I suppose Texas's widespread power failures will create some new employment opportunities for plumbers and electricians, given the many buildings and homes with burst pipes and other structural damage. But for everyone else, the state's failure to ensure minimum quality standards has been a humanitarian and economic disaster. Amid pandemic-driven unemployment, even more workers were displaced because regulators failed to ensure the basic infrastructure necessary for businesses to function. Markets, left to their own devices, sometimes fail. That's precisely the point of regulation, or should be, to correct for market failure, including by setting baseline safety and engineering standards. When it comes to the Texas grid and other demonstrable deregulatory failures, though, Republican politicians prefer to remain in the dark. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, President Biden Fell Short with Declaration, by Stuart Doreen, editor. The people who got their lights back on and the heat back on didn't get it from a windmill or solar panel. They got it from reliable fossil fuel energy. Senator Kel Seliger. And there starts and ends the lesson for those wanting to use the recent power crisis as a reason to abandon natural gas or other fossil fuels. I don't plan on telling the world that windmills and solar are the worst things in the world, but I have more confidence in fossil fuels. We know that the failures of the power grid in Texas aren't going to be solved by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. That isn't being political, just reasonable. But the goals of those on the left, when talking about what happened in Texas, isn't to convince you that their favorite sources of power worked. We know that was not the case. No, they are here to preach that fossil fuels didn't work, and therefore we can begin the transition to greener sources with a clear conscience. It's a messed up way of looking at things. However, the reaction to the power problem that we had in Texas hasn't been normal. Far from it, as we found out this weekend. It was this weekend that the Dallas Morning News reported President Joe Biden declared a major disaster for 77 Texas counties, 2 days after Governor Greg Abbott had asked for a declaration that it covered all 254 counties, copying the effects of a winter storm that knocked out power and heat across the state. Let's see, 254 versus 77. Something is off there. Did the governor shoot for the moon? Having experienced an all-time weather event inside Midland County, I'm not sure this was the case. Not surprisingly, most of West Texas was left out in the cold. Our population doesn't measure up to where the president declared disaster areas. The declaration, according to the Morning News, covers most of the Texas population, including Dallas, Fort Worth, and neighboring counties, and the counties that include Houston, San Antonio, and Austin. I try not to think that those most populated counties, Tarrant, Dallas, Behar, and Harris, also voted Democrat in the 2020 presidential election. That was probably a coincidence. Still, it isn't just me or Greg Abbott who disagreed with the president on this one. Try Sheila Jackson Lee. In fact, 27 members of the Texas House, Republican and Democrat, sent a letter to the president asking him to immediately approve the individual assistance program for all 254 counties in Texas. We fear that your initial FEMA declaration falls far short of the actual needs of our state and request the immediate approval of all 254 Texas counties for individual assistance, the members wrote in the letter. The services provided by FEMA's individual assistance programs are essential to helping states and communities recover from disasters. Although the initial effects of this unprecedented winter storm are beginning to dissipate, the entire state continues to reel from the aftermath that has left millions without power, potable water, and dwindled food supplies. Yet, yes, even Joaquin Castro is willing to say the president can do better. So do Dan Crenshaw, Eddie Bernice Johnson, and former Midlander Van Taylor, all members of the Texas delegation, and they also side with Texas west of the I-35 corridor. Thank yous also go out to Congressman August Pfluger and Henry Cuellar for leading the bipartisan effort. President Biden's initial disaster declarations left too many counties in the 11th District of Texas behind. I am proud to represent this resilient district and advocate on behalf of the hardworking men and women who live here. The President should immediately approve individual assistance for every Texas county in need, said Pfluger, the San Angelo Republican. Will that happen? Will the President have a change of heart? Probably not. This major weather event did not happen along the East Coast, but Middle America, and what happens here often doesn't measure up. What a shame. Think Louis Gohmert and Al Green are among those 27 to unite for what best for their constituents? President Biden, why won't you? This column is entitled Say Hello to Trump Deprivation Syndrome by Henry Olson, special to the Washington Post. Trump derangement syndrome, the overwrought, persistent belief that everything former President Donald Trump did was corrupt, evil, or both, has dominated political discussion for 4 years. You might have thought the condition would fade now that he is out of office. Instead, we're seeing one type of TDS replaced by another, Trump deprivation syndrome. Politicians and all journalists of all stripes have become so addicted to dissecting Trump's every move that they can't seem to give him up. Trump diehards within the Republican Party are making their unswerving loyalty to him a regular feature of their online commentary. The political media is driving the story of a riven GOP, irrevocably broken into pro- and anti-Trump factions, on an almost daily basis. Democrats are pushing for a January 6th commission to look into the Capitol riot, a move that will keep Trump in the news for months to come. He's out of sight, but he's not out of mind. Money is surely a motive for some afflicted by the new TDS. Ratings for political news shows, especially on some cable networks, rose dramatically during the Trump years. Producers and hosts know that obsessively covering the former president attracts eyeballs, even if it's just the political version of looky-loos who can't avert their gaze from a roadside crash. Print journalists also know that many people just can't get enough of Trump. Chasing clicks with more stories on America's best-known political villain is, for some, simply good business. For these folks, never Trump really means ever Trump. Politicians on both sides have similar motives. Many minor Republican politicians became small-time celebrities on Fox News by their reliable support of whatever Trump said or did. If Trump fades from view, they may fade from view too. But TDS is likelier to infect the Democratic side. Their narrow coalition ranges across the ideological aisle, from staunch Democratic socialists, such as the members of the Squad, to former Republicans who still pine for the GOP of their youth. This diverse collection is united by only one thing, hatred or dislike of Trump. The more Trump's misdeeds or potential return to power is kept front and center, the likelier it is that Democrats can retain control of both chambers of Congress in next year's midterms. There's one important figure, however, for whom Trump deprivation syndrome is a bad idea, President Biden. He has an ambitious agenda, and he will need to marshal public support for it now and in the future. He can't do that unless people are talking about him, not his predecessor. There's also a simple matter of ego. Politicians are known to have an outsized sense of self, and it surely rankles Biden that he vanquished Trump in the election and still can't dominate the nightly news. Perhaps both reasons are why he told the audience for his nationally televised town hall last week that he is tired of talking about Donald Trump. If only. Trump retains our attention because he is a compelling personality, and purveyors of popular entertainment have long known that people want to follow interesting people. It's not enough just to be a great actor, an amazing entrepreneur, or a sports legend. If public attention and the force it can bring are your goal, you have to create controversy or build a larger-than-life persona that makes people look up with wonder. Trump spent his entire life building that persona, whether in New York's tabloids or via reality television, and he knows how to make people watch. Now that he's gone, or at least not making daily appearances or comments, he has left a gaping void that many had become dependent upon. They just can't let him go. Trump will probably feed this hunger like the public relations master that he is. He'll peek out over the parapets of Mar-a-Lago just enough to keep his name and mug in our minds, giving TDS addicts enough of a fix to keep them going. When election season starts in earnest next year, he'll ramp up his appearances and launch his comeback. The political story for much of 2022 won't be whether Democrats and Biden retain control of Congress. It will be whether Trump can oust his Republican opponents and retain control of the GOP. None of this is good for a badly broken country. Right and left should move on from Trump and let our democracy heal from his narcissism. But there's no vaccine that protects us from TDS. The fact is, we can't seem to break his habit. It means the body politic will continue to suffer from this infection for years to come. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, February 24th, 2021. Cruz S. Esquivel. Cruz S. Esquivel, 75, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, February 20th, surrounded by his family. Rosary will be held on Thursday, February 25th at 7 p.m. at the branch at NPW, 3800 North Big Spring Street, Midland. Funeral Mass will be held on Friday, February 26th, at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Fairview Cemetery. Cruz was born in Mexico on May 3, 1945, to father Benancio Esquivel and mother Manuela Esquivel. Besides his wife, Ninfa, Cruz is survived by his three sons and two daughters, Jamie and Cruz Jr. of San Antonio, Luis, Gabby, and Anna of Midland, and 13 grandchildren, and five siblings, as well as numerous nieces, nephews, and other relatives and friends. Pallbearers will be Jamie Esquivel, Cruz Esquivel Jr., Luis Esquivel, Jaime Esquivel, Cruz Esquivel III, and Caden Esquivel. The family welcomes any thoughts, prayers, and or flowers. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. David Harper Essex. On February 13, 2021, David Harper Essex passed away from injuries sustained in a one-vehicle accident near Menard, Texas. David was 68 years old. David was born on November 9, 1952, in Fort Worth, Texas, and his parents were Barbara and Frank Essex. David is survived by his sister Hollis, Holly Reimers, and husband Delbert of Orland, California, daughters Elise Louise Ansley and husband Mark, and their children of Frisco, and daughter Hillary Essex Armstrong and her husband Jack and their children of Austin, Texas. Also, two grandchildren of his late son David Harper Essex Jr., stepson William Thomas Brown, Bill, and wife Allison with their children, stepdaughter Bliss Brown Nauert and her children of Rockwall, Texas, and his girlfriend Teresa Hansen of Midland, Texas. A celebration of David's life will be held at Midland Country Club on February 24th from 2 to 4 p.m. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests donations to Gladney Center for Adoption, 6300 John Ryan Drive, Fort Worth, 76132, or to Midland Shared Spaces, 3500 North A Street, Suite 1100, Midland, 79707, or to a charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Donald Roy Langley. Donald Roy Langley, 71, of Midland, passed away February 21, 2021. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, February 24th at Nallie Picklin Wells Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, February 25th at Nallie Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel. with interment following at Serenity Memorial Garden Cemetery. Mr. Langley was born April 9, 1949, in Odessa to Carl and Irene Langley. Donald is survived by his sons Danny, David, and Roy Langley. There are also 10 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren, and 1 brother, Marvin Langley. He is preceded in death by his wife, Lois Marie Langley, his mother and father, and 2 brothers and 1 sister. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Jolene West Sullivan. Jolene West Sullivan, age 85, died peacefully at home in the early morning hours of Wednesday, February 17th, and stepped into her eternal promise and the glorious presence of Jesus. In deference to health risk factors, a memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, April 24th, at the Hamill Family Funeral Home, 6449 Buffalo Gap Road. Jolene was born on March 1, 1935, in Big Spring, Texas, to parents Ettie Pearl and Alfred Gordon West. Jolene is survived by her daughter Sherry Sullivan Fitzhugh and granddaughter Kathleen Pearl Jonathan Kovac and great-grandson Benjamin Miles. Jolene is also survived by her bonus daughter, Gail Tom Carr, as well as numerous nieces, nephews, and bonus grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Jolene was preceded in death by her husband, Richard K. Sullivan, as well as her sister, Sherry Lynn John Temple, parents Pearl and Gordon West, aunt and uncle Alma and H.W. McIntyre, and son-in-law Randall K. Fitzhugh. Jolene was well-loved and will be missed by all. In lieu of flowers, donations in Jolene's memory may be made to the Abilene Philharmonic Foundation, Abilene Women's Club, Hardin-Simmons University, and Hendrick Home for Children. Memories may be shared and condolences submitted online at www.hamillfamilyfuneralhome.com. Lovey Joanne Robertson. Lovey Joanne Robertson of Midland passed away on Monday, February 15th. Services will be at 2 p.m. on Saturday, February 27th at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel in Midland. Lovey Joanne Robertson was born April 5, 1930, in Clifton, Texas, to Jesse George and Eva Fincher. She was doted on by her son, daughter-in-law, Beverly Robertson, and Chihuahua Sandy. Joanne is survived by her son, George Galloway Robertson. The family would like to express their gratitude towards Home Hospice and Legacy Memory Care. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Manuela Ibarra. Manuela Ibarra, 70, our beloved mother, sister, grandmother, great-grandmother, and aunt, was called to heaven on February 15, 2021. Rosary was held at 7 p.m. Tuesday, February 23rd at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, February 24th at St. Stephen's Catholic Church. The daughter of Manuela Valero and David Garcia, Manuela was born August 4, 1950 in Marathon, Texas. She was united in marriage to Rodolfo Rudy Ibarra on June 28, 1969 in Alpine. She is survived by her husband of 51 years, Rudy V. Ibarra, daughter Yvonne Tenorio and husband Rick, son Rudy Adrian Ibarra and wife Alexis, 4 sisters Clemencia Lopez and husband Robert, Genoveva Villarreal, Minerva Mancha, and Maria Elidia Hinojos. She was also survived by Angel Valles, a grandnephew who she raised, 8 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren, 4 step-grandchildren, and 7 step-great-grandchildren. Manuela was preceded in death by 2 sisters, Irene Flores and Ramona Molinar, and 2 brothers, Antonio Garcia and Adrian Garcia. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Mary Alice Hogue. A memorial service for Mary Alice Hogue is planned for Friday, February 26, 2 p.m., at First Baptist Church, Midland. January 4th, 2021, Mary Alice passed away peacefully at her home of natural causes. She was 97 years old. Mary Alice was born July 25th, 1923, in rural Smith County, Texas, near Tyler. Her parents were Reverend Clark O. Hitt and Anna Mary Shank Hitt. Mary Alice was the oldest child and only daughter out of six children. The children were sometimes referred to as five hits and a miss. On June 25, 1943, she married Cliff Hogue in Lancaster, Texas, and then joined Cliff in Midland. The Lord gave Cliff and Mary Alice three wonderful children, all born in Midland: Cliff Pete Hogue, Jr., Evelyn Ben Paul Hogue, and Carol Jan Hogue Williams David. They have five grandchildren, five step-grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren, one adopted great-grandchild, and 15 step-great-grandchildren. No viewing or cemetery service. Cliff and Mary Alice willed their bodies to Texas Tech Medical School to help advance medical science. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations may be made to Living Hope Church, 740 Bramwell, Green River, Wyoming, 82935. Paula Susanna Neal. Paula Susanna Neal, 62, passed away on Friday, February 19th in Dallas after an extended illness. Paula was born July 3rd, 1958 in Midland, Texas, to John E. Neal, Jr. and Jenny Davis Neal. Paula and her twin sister Pam grew up and attended schools in Midland, but graduated from high school at the U.S. Embassy School in Jakarta, Indonesia, while their father was working there as a geophysicist. Paula was preceded in death by her parents, John E. Neal and Jenny Neal Davis. She is survived by her twin sister, Pam Floyd, and husband, Jeff Floyd of Midland, brother, John Eric Neal, and wife, Callie McCaslin Neal, and sister, Shauna Greenwood of Denver, Colorado, niece, Christy Morales, and husband, Caleb of Del Rio, Texas, nephew, Shane Anthony Neal of San Diego, California, cousins, Sherry Ladd, Janet Cross, Diana Dickey, all of Midland. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests a gift in Paula's name to the following charity: Lone Star Sanctuary for Animals, 4200 North Fairgrounds Road, Midland, 79705. Celebration of Life will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, February 26th at Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. Eloisa V. Flores. Eloisa V. Flores, 79, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, February 14th. Viewing will be held on Thursday, February 25th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a prayer service to be held at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral service is set for Friday, February 26th at 10 a.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Burial will follow at Fairview Cemetery. She is survived by one son, Armando H. Flores, two daughters, Naomi Sanchez and Joyce Flores Reyes, three sisters, six grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren, and four great-great-grandchildren. Joan Cox. Joan Cox, 85, of Midland, passed away February 22nd. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, February 26th, at Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home in Midland. Celebration of Life will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 27th, at Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Torvald DeVoy Crisp. Torvald DeVoy Crisp passed away February 14, 2021. Visitation will be held Friday, February 26th, from 9 a.m. till 8 p.m. Family will be receiving friends from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home, 1502 North La Mesa Road. Funeral service will be held Saturday, February 27th at 11 a.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Survivors include his wife, Deborah Powell, parents Herbert and Betty Crisp, grandmother Carrie Simon, grandfather Johnny O'Neill, daughter Kayla Marie Crisp, sons Cameron Ethan Crisp, Christian Miles Crisp, three sisters and one brother. Arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Funeral Home. Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Odessa American for Wednesday, February 24th. COVID cases down in Odessa. Mass vaccines continue at Ratliff by Federico Martinez. COVID-19 cases in Odessa have dipped to the lowest numbers since the pandemic began in March. Pleased local health officials announced during a virtual press conference on Tuesday. Officials credited the decrease on the thousands of people who have already been vaccinated during the past 1.5 months, and an increase in residents wearing face coverings, social distancing, and following sanitizing protocols. We are seeing a downward trend in our community, which is reflective of what we're seeing across the country, Ector County Health Authority Dr. Barbatund Jinadu said. The vaccines and masks are contributing to the lower number, but we're not out of the woods yet. Local hospital COVID-19 numbers back up Jinadu's claims. Medical Center hospital officials on Tuesday reported there are currently 37 COVID patients at the hospital, 16 in intensive care, and 12 people on ventilators. For the past 4 months, MCH was averaging about 70 patients per day, officials said. Odessa Regional Medical Center reported 7 patients, all of which are in critical condition, and 2 patients on ventilators. ORMC had been averaging about 30 COVID patients per day since October. These were the lowest numbers we've had since March, when the pandemic started, ORMC President Stacy Brown said. MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin concurred. ORMC Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohith Saravanan served up more good news. The COVID positivity rate in Odessa is under 20%, for the first time since June 2020, Saravanan said. For the past 7 months, the positivity rate had been stuck at 40% or higher. Yes, 20% is still too high, but it's a big improvement, Saravanan said. What we're seeing is the results of people wearing masks properly. 4 to 6 weeks later, we're seeing the results. A couple more months of this and we will be back to normal, or as close to normal as we can ever be. Saravanan said it's unlikely that COVID-19 will ever be totally eliminated, but it can be controlled like other diseases. The virus doesn't appear to be able to mutate as widely as the flu, he said. It wasn't all good news. On Tuesday, the CDC announced that 500,000 people have died so far from COVID-19. We reached that milestone today, as somber Saravanan acknowledged. That's quite a staggering number. It's nauseating to think something like this can happen in this day and age. Tippin announced on Tuesday that MCH this week received 6,000 doses of the Pfizer vaccine, an increase over the 3,900 doses the hospital had previously been receiving. MCH did not receive a vaccine shipment last week due to harsh wintry conditions, which also forced the hospital to cancel vaccination events planned at Ratliff Stadium, Tippin said. The mass vaccinations will resume 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Wednesday and 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Thursday and Sunday at Ratliff Stadium. Those dates are only for those who need the first shot and not for those seeking the second shot or booster. After February 28th, the vaccines will most likely be administered at local clinics, although those details are still being finalized, Tippin said. Residents who receive their first vaccination shots at Ratliff this week and after will receive the second booster shots through ORMC, a partnership both hospitals recently announced. ORMC will begin administering the booster shots during the first week of March, Saravanan said. The hospital will use a portal system that will automatically contact people by email to let them know when and where they should go to receive their second shot. After last week's vaccine shipments did not arrive, MCH was also forced to cancel thousands of appointments for people who were scheduled to receive their booster shots at urgent care clinics. Instead of trying to reschedule appointments, officials opted to offer mass Pfizer booster vaccination events 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. March 2nd through 5th at Ratliff Stadium. No appointment is necessary, but attendees should bring their card indicating they have already received their first shot, officials said. Those that do not have proof that they have received the initial vaccine will not be served. New Medical Examiners HQ coming. Need for more spacious facility attested by commissioners. Ector County commissioners on Tuesday okayed using $88,500 in Federal CARES Act money to construct a bigger building for the medical examiner's office near the sheriff's office and jail south of Odessa off U.S. 385. Chief Medical Investigator Ron Inge attended the 10 a.m. meeting to say he needed more supplies and a cooler with a capacity for 20 bodies, Precinct 3 Commissioner Don Stringer reported. Inge said the current medical examiner's headquarters at 200 A West 3rd Street are much too small. The plan was approved on a 4-1 vote with Precinct 2 Commissioner Greg Simmons voting no, he said, because the building would increase the county's insurance costs and liability. Precinct 1 Commissioner Mike Gardner had said Monday that the ME's office used a mobile storage system for bodies during the pandemic. They've been overwhelmed and are looking for a long-term solution, he said. Stringer had said Monday that the ME's office is understaffed and under square footaged. In other business, the court held an executive session in which the commissioners and Judge Debbie Hayes interviewed two applicants to fill the newly created post of public information officer. The position is still open, and I hope we will have a decision in the next few meetings, Stringer said Tuesday. We need more positive things coming out about us. Stringer has said in a Monday interview that a PIO would make it easier for the media to cover county government, and Gardner said that then that a full-time spokesperson would provide a better flow of information.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.